Now I'm going to have some fun. You know, we started this show, and I have a requirement of the show where I read the books before the participant comes on, the author comes on. And I heard Hal on an earlier show on another program on W1RI on the world-famous John Dion show. And they go way, way back. And Terry McKenna, another good friend of mine from our car wholesaling days at Bob's Auto Supply, Chapel Street Auto Sales, and Henry Bork and Terry. And, you know, we had a carpool every Wednesday going to the Southern Auction. And I says, I don't want to rain on John's parade, but I says, I've got to re-interview Hal because there's questions that I wanted to ask, and I wanted to get caught up from our business relationship and friendship that we had in the late 60s and early 70s, and how fast time goes by. Now, how Shawnee just come up with this book, and we had a nice conversation before we came on, and 17 years in the making of this fine piece of work, and I can proudly say this is one of the few books or one of my top favorite books that I got into this week because it almost mirrored my career and my business career in the Rhode Island, Northern Rhode Island market area. I classify the book as a historical for what he put into it. It's also his memoir. It's also, most important of all, a true story because I'd never met anybody more a man of his word than Hal. And it's also a great story on the current rules and the stacked deck that we live in with the Rhode Island and the federal government bankruptcy system that I don't know how we're going to fix this problem, but it's costing a lot of entrepreneurs in this country and Rhode Island their life's work. Good morning, Hal.
Hey, good morning, Wayne.
Fantastic.
Thanks for the nice intro. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your hard work and putting a book that I'm going to get extra copies for my grandkids.
Great. Thank you.
It's that good. I rate it that high.
Wow.
Now, we go back, way, way back. You had Cumberland Coin on Menden Road up there in the Cumberland area on a part-time basis. I believe you were still teaching at the time.
That's correct. I'm kind of like a workaholic. I do a few things at the same time. I was teaching, I was flying with the reserves, and also opened up a coin shop at the same time. A mom-and-pop coin shop at the time, yes.
Very similarities. The Barber family has been self-employed in Northern Rhode Island since 1871, five generations. Now it's my turn. And the work ethics were handed down by grandparents, great-grandparents, parents, brothers, sisters. My kids are workaholics, and I'm sure yours are too. And the descriptions of the work ethic that you had from your father on the route,
right,
on the junk route that he had, and working with your brothers and stuff like that for scratch money, and learn the value of a dollar at an early age. It's a shame it's not passed on now with
there
generations.
Family value system then was a little bit different than what it is today, unfortunately.
The other part that I got into that, where you mentioned that every salesman, and there were a lot of businessmen that made house visits in that era. And I remembered, even up in the sticks, up in Barreville, we lived, brought up in the Mapleville at the Barber Farm, and we had an insurance man that came from North Smithfield once a month, and my mother had the envelope for him, and was different endowments, different funds that she had set up, hopefully for a college for one of the seven kids. And then we had Cambio that used to come with fresh bread every 2 weeks. An Italian guy would come up from North Providence. And even in the sticks up in Barreville, we had that same relationships with entrepreneurs in the state of Rhode Island, which was so refreshing to have thoughts in a book to remind me of my growing up.
It's very, very personal. You got to know the Eggman and the person who delivered the groceries, and even a butcher would come and deliver the meat to the house. And, you know, I just remember my mother sitting down at the table drinking tea with all of these people and chatting with them. And they weren't in a big rush to leave. even though they were in business.
I'm going to reveal something to the listening audience right now before we get to these accumulated emails that have been piling in for 2 days since I've been promoting the show. The first $1,000 I put in the bank was because of you.
Really? Wow.
I was working over at Rochambeau Wisted in Manville, Mass., and the coffee man that was coming there was a representative, a union coffee man from Fromont Brothers Catering in Cumberland. And Mark Keogh was his name. He's still catering till this day, driving a coffee truck. And I says, I think I can do this. He said, well, this is union, you know. This is 251 Teamsters Union. He said, you're only 17. He says, I'd have to sign a waiver and get you nominated and sponsor you. So Paul Hanoian got me into the union. And the very first book that I read, wrote, was 4 Million Miles in 42 Years. And that was my industrial, commercial driving career for 1968 to 2012. And I accumulated 4 million miles without a chargeable accident.
Wow.
But getting back to the $1,000, I accumulated a tremendous amount of silver coins. And that was the rage. It was a quick fix to make a couple extra bucks. And at that time, you could actually get lucky enough to get a roll of dimes or quarters from the bank that were entirely silver, where the older people cashed in their coins and had no idea what it was. And I kept that in a separate fund, withheld. I used to cash it in religiously. And that was the first $1,000 I ever accumulated.
Well, good for you, Wayne. Very good.
The first time I've ever revealed that. That's how attached we are, as in this book. Our similarities of our lifestyles, starting out as entrepreneurs, getting our feet wet, our first marriages, and working the Rhode Island system to try to make a buck.
And you have a passion for what you do, which is very, very important.
Yep. Now, going from Cumberland Coin, three jobs, wearing a lot of hats, always the provider like your dad was. And he really passed on some great virtues. I thank my mother and father for the same thing every day of my life, especially my grandparents. You go and make the big move, and you come down to Woonsocket, right next to the Stadium Theater, I think it was.
That's correct. 325 Main Street.
Yep. Yes. Building is still there, and Terry McKenna across the street. And turns out to be one of the largest businesses in Northern Rhode Island overnight.
I remember during the gold and silver rush of 1979 and 1980, we had lines of people that went past the Stadium Theater, and we had to hire the police to keep them, literally keep these people in line. We had up to 1,000 people a day coming in selling gold and silver, because silver got to $50 an ounce, and gold reached $850 in Hong Kong, but backed off to $800 in the United States.
Now, you branched off at that time with different corporations, artwork, expanded your business base and stuff like that, using your entrepreneur skills of buying and selling, buy low, sell high. And you've actually bought collections in your lifetime?
Tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions, Wayne. And I brought the company public. We opened up an office in Boston, one in New York, one in Vancouver, one in Toronto, and Woonsocket, where I had started off. So I had five offices at the same time, and we were doing very, very well.
Fantastic. Then big government put the hammer to you.
Well, actually, what happens is when banks fail, they drag businesses down with them. And like in Rhode Island, you had a banking crisis in the early 90s, when Governor Sumlin came in the 1st of January, 1991, he closed all the credit unions. And, you know, the credit unions were backed up by RISDIC, and the regular banks were backed up by FDIC. So you had a bunch of RISDIC failures. You had, locally, you had Eastland Bank went under in 1992. You had Old Stone Bank went under the following year, 1991. You had a Cranston Bank went under that was taken over by FDIC. I think it was Colonial Federal. And between 1990 and 1993, you had 500 businesses that were dragged under because the banks went under. And during the next 6 years after that, you had only 200 businesses went under. So there's a direct correlation when financial institutions fail, it just brings businesses down with them because they call the notes.
Now, to our listening audience worldwide on the live stream that we have, we referenced that part of American banking crisis in Rhode Island called the DEPCO period.
Yes.
That's mm-hmm. how it was labeled. Do you agree when Sunland came in, shutting it down, or could there have been another way of doing it with the assistance of the federal government, or was it too big of a problem?
That's a very good question. You know, I'm very opinionated. I think that banks like Fleet had a great deal of influence on the state government in Rhode Island because a lot of the high-risk loans, or what were considered high-risk loans, were being taken on by the credit unions. And those banks under FDIC, I feel, were a little bit jealous of it, and they probably encouraged the takeover of the credit union system. But that's just an opinion. I don't have anything really to back it up.
I agree with you 100%. I was also in awe learning the political system in Rhode Island at that time as a young lad and getting my feet wet on how few people went to prison on that dilemma.
Well, it's just like what happened in 2008 when you had the mortgage crisis in the United States. Very few people from Wall Street were targeted. And so it appears to me like government looks for somebody to blame for a bank going under or whatever. I felt somewhat that Eastland Bank was kind of blaming a $2.5 million loan that Cumberland had with them as one of the reasons that a $600 million institution went under. However, it was just too small.
So
too
you
small a deal.
Easiest one to pick on
sure,
target.
Sure. I was local.
Okay. I got to mention one other thing that we have a similarity on. It's discussed in the book, in the memoir part of it. I personally have had 5 career concussions that are documented. And you write about the big head injury that you got while you were in prison.
Yes.
That it still affects you to this day. Where do you see that going medically on our problems with our concussions? Do you see long-term effects on this? Or do you think with the medicines that are now available coming out every day to help people with concussion problems will be our answer?
I think once you have a traumatic brain injury, you're never the same. And we have a lot of the troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan that have the tandem injury of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as this traumatic brain injury. I don't believe you ever really heal from this. You may learn how to cope with it. Learn different ways of doing things, but the truth of the matter is the brain injury is still there and you never really recover from it 100%.
Okay, we're going to have to get into the emails because it's only a one-hour show.
Okay.
I got just one question on the bankruptcy in Rhode Island. Is the current situation on bankruptcy laws in Rhode Island fixable in your mind in Rhode Island?
Well, the federal bankruptcy laws, and even though it's federal bankruptcy laws, you have local procedures that every bankruptcy court has. It's just the way that they do things in-house. Is it fixable? Yes, it is fixable. But one of the problems is you have these national commissions that are made up primarily of attorneys, and they have one accountant on it, and they put in recommendations to Congress about changes in the law. And you don't have anybody on these commissions representing, which I feel are the victims of bankruptcy, the debtor, the person in bankruptcy. He's called the debtor, okay, instead of the bankrupt person. And I don't believe he's properly represented in these commissions, and it would be a smart play to have some input from someone that has been victimized by the system.
Okay, fantastic answer. Okay, you got your seatbelt on?
Sure.
I've gone through this and screened them, and they are appropriate for the airways. First email is from for Hal, from Sean from Springfield, Mass. He says, as your business expertise, starting a business, should I do a sole proprietorship, an LLC, or a full-blown corporation?
There's pluses and minuses to whichever one of those three you choose to do. Often, attorneys will tell you to get incorporated because that means fees for them to draw up the corporation. But when you enter into a bankruptcy, and there's a lot of people represent themselves in a bankruptcy in a pro se capacity. If you are in a corporate status, you cannot represent the corporation. You need an attorney to do it. So the minus of incorporating is if you end up in a bankruptcy or you feel you're going to do it, then perhaps you're better off as a sole proprietor and not incorporated.
And eliminate those fees.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we've got a second one here. An email from Peter from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Is putting money year to year in your retirement account protected even if you go into bankruptcy?
That's a very good question. I know when Tilden Thurber went into bankruptcy in Rhode Island, and Bill Thurber who was one of the brothers who was a partner in it when it went under, and of course they were in business since the Civil War, and I believe that he did not receive all of the pension money that he had put into it. I really can't answer the question for you 100% because there are various loopholes that people use in order to protect themselves.
So check with an attorney or do a lot of research on it before you start that part
of it. I would say, especially with a tax attorney versus just a jack-of-all-trades attorney, yes.
Now, here's a real hot question because it was on national TV last night. Email directed to Hal only. Hal, this is Sandy from Pawtucket. She knows you. You probably don't remember her, she says. How did Donald Trump use his bankruptcy situation to his advantage?
Well, actually, the way the laws are written, there's an order of priority of payments. And the first parties to get paid are the secured creditors, like a bank that files a UCC filing against the estate of the bankrupt. And then it goes where the attorneys get paid and the professionals, the accountants and whatever.
A pecking order.
And the last person to get paid is the unsecured creditor. That's the person, the plumber, the carpenter, the person that doesn't have all of these forms to fill out, that a boilerplate language sign here and they're protected and whatever. So they're the last on the pecking order. And as a result of that, the bankruptcy court's not a court of equity where everybody gets their fair share. And so if the money gets paid off the top, usually in the average bankruptcy case that I've seen, 10% is left over where the creditor, who's not a secured creditor, ends up with 10 cents on the dollar in general. Yep. In general, yes.
Fantastic answer. I got an email here from Ben E. from Foster, Rhode Island, and he's just making a comment he'd like to have put over the air. In his opinion, he says, politicians do not control Rhode Island, lawyers do.
Well, I would say a lot of the lawyers, a lot of the politicians are lawyers. If you take a look, it's the judges are lawyers, the lawyers are lawyers, everybody that, most of the people in power are in the legal profession somehow or other.
Yep, they're associated with it.
I would say so, yes.
Okay, this one here, I think it's appropriate for the year because it is a part of your life story. It's in the book. You were in prison for 7 years?
No, I was in prison for 19 months.
19 months?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did going to prison affect your military status or any of your military pension?
No, no, it did not. When you're in prison, you cannot collect any pensions or Social Security or whatever. They usually, Bureau of Prisons finds a job for you where you're working at 12 cents an hour somehow or other. Okay. But no, it doesn't affect your pension or Social Security once you're out of incarceration, yes.
I don't know why, but the person knows you're very financial literate. And it says, how much has the legal casinos affected the New England economy?
I really don't have any statistics on it. I can only, once again, formulate an opinion, but I mean it's strictly an opinion. I would imagine that there are a lot of hardworking people who have a gambling addiction. In fact, even in prison, there's people go to meetings for gambling addiction. Prison has plenty of people with gambling addictions. And as a result, they end up losing their houses to Foxwood or elsewhere. And it hurts a lot of people who are addicted, but you can say the same thing for those addicted to drugs or alcohol or whatever. So once you go into this ism where you abuse a substance, then there's usually a bad result. So
there's another part in your book on your military career with all the flying that you did around the world internationally, and you were in a position where you really took advantage of the difference in currency and the types of currency from Greece,
yes.
The gold coins and stuff like that. And my question to you is, how did you attach any of these purchases to transport home while you were in the service? How did you get them on the planes? Was there a separate set of paperwork, or were they smuggled?
No, no, no. You could carry it in 100% legally and lawfully. I remember going to the Bank of Athens and buying the 100 drachma coins with the five kings on it. And the king and queen, Constantine, and I forgot what the queen's name was, but basically, there were, excuse me, I said 100 drachmas, there were 30 drachmas. There was 30 drachmas to the dollar, and so for every coin that I bought, and I brought back bags of 1,000, I could sell them virtually right away for $4,000 to $5,000.
Wow.
And just a quick flip, there were people that wanted them, and I did that in multiples. And, you know, instead of being, a lot of people, they went and they flew to different places, and they were interested in going to the barrooms and having a good time and whatever. And I was interested in doing other things.
And making some money while
sure.
you're doing it.
Sure.
Do you still have international ties today after all of this time?
I'll tell you the truth. I don't know who's still alive or not. You know, I'm 77 years old now. And when I travel to these places, I thought I was maybe 15, 20 years younger than the people I was dealing with in Plaza Mayor in Spain or in Bexhill in London. So are these people still alive? I really don't know, but I think that most of them are not. But the businesses are probably still there, and their sons or other people who learned the business are still running it, probably.
I got exposed to that going up to the hockey games in Quebec and Montreal with the different conversion rates of U.S. and Canadian money.
Sure.
And so many people actually made money at it. And in your level, going from all these different countries around the world, that must have put you in a great position to really do some good flipping.
I was in a good position. Usually a coin is worth more in the country of origin. So I used to bring good Spanish coins to Spain and sell them to the Spanish dealers, and they would sell me U.S. coins. Same thing in London. And London, I bought a lot of U.S. colonial coins there, and they have a different grading system. They have what's called a good extra fine, which is at least and almost uncirculated to uncirculated in the using U.S. grading, and that differential in grading made huge differences on very rare pieces, and I did quite well with it. It's a battle of wits, you know. It's you versus the brain power of who you're dealing with.
Got an email from Tom from Boston. He wants to know, did you self-publish?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it's basically the book is published by the Money School of Boston.
Okay.
But I had to put it through Create Space, which is a division of Amazon.
Yeah.
But that's like the name that they allow you to use, whatever publishing name that you would like to.
You've used a lot of black and white photos, too, to save the cost of the color photos.
Well, if you had color photos in this book placed the way I do, because, you see, the Kindle form of this book is nowhere as good, in my opinion, as the printed, because I've had the rights from Budget Films, which is the largest private film library in the world, to use pictures of pirates in different silent movies like The Black Pirate. And I feel it adds to the message of what I'm trying to say. So,
our listening audience, what would they hope to achieve by reading the book? Is it a historical, really good type of read? Is it a business type of book? Or is it beware of the word bankruptcy?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects to this. If you were a person who wanted just to know about family values back in when I was growing up in the 50s, for instance, and 60s, you could reminisce and go down memory lane with that. But basically, it's pot memoir, it's pot expose, and also pot how-to. There are some technical parts of the book that's not for everyone, and you can feel free to skip around and just read those sections which are applicable to you. There's 740 pages. There's a lot of material there and a lot of research into different areas. So if you are a historian and you want to know about the history of piracy in the United States and worldwide, and it's there, but also there's the comparisons of the tactics used by pirates in days of yore with what's being done today.
Yep.
A lot of comparisons.
Are you working on another book now?
I'm toying with another book. Yes. Yes,
very
I
good.
Am.
It's we'll
about,
get that on the air.
It's about real assets never disappear. They only change hands.
One other question I got to hear was an email that came in just before I left this morning. Gold and silver markets, are they manipulated by certain countries or cartels?
I really feel they are. For instance, if you take a look at platinum today, you have an inversion where platinum is probably $250 less per ounce than gold is. So if gold were at $1,340, you have platinum at $1,000 and change, and that's called an inversion when usually platinum is much more than gold. Well, at least 20% more, and now it's 20% less. There's some people feel that marketplace is being manipulated to punish Russia, which is the largest holder of platinum.
Russia is.
Yes. Mr. Yes, Putin. I believe so.
Well, soon to be Mr. Trump, too. Okay, the name of the book is Pirates, and great cover, and I want to thank you for your service.
Okay, we thank you.
And Those Who Plunder You Into Bankruptcy by Hal Shawney, available on Amazon. Any other local stores in the area carrying it now?
No, not that I know of. However, after the show, I'm going to go to my son's store at 325 Main Street next to the Stadium Theater. And I'm going to be there till like noontime today. If somebody wants to come in, I'll give him an autographed copy at $25 instead of the $34.95 that they would be charged if they ordered it on Amazon.
Oh, and I won't tell the IRS about that reduction.
So. Okay, good enough.
No, the name of the book is Pirates. It's a must-read, historical Rhode Island information, business laws and bankruptcy, and well thought out, well laid out. It's a very thick book, but I like the size of the print with my eyes, and it really gets the message home on the Rhode Island business scene and federal government bankruptcy system we have. Thank you very much, Al.
Okay, we thank you, Wayne.
And have one of the best days of your life.
You too, thanks.